Thank you all so much for being here. I have to tell you right now, I'm just a tad bit nervous, so I'm just going to get that out there. But like I shared with someone here sitting at the table just a minute ago, it's my story and you can't really mess that up. So, you know, we'll just go with it. I'd like to thank the Happy Destiny, Al-Anon Family Group, my sponsor, all of y'all, my fellow travelers. But most importantly, I need to thank my higher power for giving me this opportunity, this incredible opportunity. Without all of the individuals I just mentioned, I know I wouldn't be where I am today. So I'm extremely grateful. I'm very, very honored. I mean, I was super honored when I was asked to speak tonight, but I'm very humbled at the same time because I feel like I'm just a baby on my journey here. But I know that I have a lot more to go, and I'm looking forward to that because I've seen in the last 3+ years some growth, and so I can't wait to see what's going to happen as I continue on my journey. Before I came up here this afternoon, you know, I did pray. I'm very big on that, and I just asked my higher power to just speak through me, to give me the words that somebody out there might need to hear something that I have to say and what I share. So with that being said, my sponsor told me at the very beginning of this, when we first started working together, that service work and giving back was where it was at in this program. And so she said, if someone asks you to help or to speak, you just simply say, yes, I'd love to do that. And so here's my story. I was born into what I considered a very normal family. I had two parents, had been married the entire time. I had an older sister. I have a younger brother. I had both sets of living grandparents, several aunts, uncles, and cousins. And we spent a lot of our time, at either one or both of my grandparents' houses having picnics. We were huge on picnics. I lived in Michigan, so when the weather got warm and we got together, we spent the time in Grandma or Grandpa's backyard, and we had picnics and did the family thing that way. And we had a great time. I thought I had a great life, and I really did, until it wasn't good anymore. What happened was my grandfather was a very heavy drinker, and I can remember him coming over to our house. And he'd come in the back door, and he'd just walk down the steps into the basement. Living in Michigan, you know, we had basements, and that's where my mom did the laundry, and we had a little play area for my sister and I. My sister had a piano down there that she could practice on. But my grandfather would walk in the back door, and he'd go directly to the basement, and he'd do whatever down there. We didn't really know. He wouldn't come through the house and say hi. He wouldn't even, let us know he was there. We just knew he was there. And then when I was about 6 or 7, playing down in the basement with my sister, I had discovered my grandpa's secret. He hid a bottle on the top shelf of this big, tall bookcase that was next to our dryer. And I watched him come down the stairs and walk over to that bottle, and he would drink. He would stand there and drink for however long. And then he'd leave. But he always came back several times a day. And I later learned that he was telling my grandmother that he was going for a ride. He was going to go drive down to the beach. And I'm sure he did, but he was pretty loaded when he left our house and did that. So he did this as long as I can remember, until I was about 8 years old. And then things changed for me. It was then that my grandfather started doing things to me that no little girl should ever have to endure. And I became very, very withdrawn. My whole persona changed. And at that time, I really couldn't put a label on how I had changed or what I was feeling. But today I know that I was extremely emotional. I felt like I'd never fit in. I was very, very unsure of myself. I was uneasy around everybody, my sister, my brother. I had a deep jealousy of my brother. He was younger than me, and I was the baby until he came along. And so when all of this behavior started, I just really took it out on him, and I hated him. I truly did. My personality would just change at the drop of a hat. You know, my sister will say today that she didn't know what was going on with me then, but I was just different. I just changed. One time I would be happy or I would be laughing, and then at a second's notice, I would just be uncontrollably crying. So I began to eat. I began to eat because I thought if I became really fat, that my grandfather would leave me alone. And unfortunately, that didn't happen, but I did begin to gain weight, and I truly battle my weight to this day. And I don't know whether it's true or not, but I blame that on my grandfather. I haven't been able to take that and say, you know, get rid of that feeling yet. I didn't know how to deal with what was happening to me, but I knew that I hated him. I hated to be around him. And in a weird way, I hated my mom because it was my mother's father. And although I never said anything to her, I never told her, I was 8 years old, 8, 9, 10 years old, and I thought, how in the world can I tell my mother what's going on? First of all, I didn't think she'd believe me. And I just didn't want to think about it. I just didn't want anybody to know. So I kept that all deep, deep, deep inside of me. I hated drinking. I hated alcohol. I hated the smell of it. And all of this continued until my grandfather, after a couple of years, my grandfather had a heart attack. And he stopped drinking. But by this time, I was already way off in my unhappiness, and I didn't know how to not feel those feelings that I was having. So not only was my grandfather a heavy drinker, but his father, I learned later, was a very mean drinker. My uncle, his son, was a very heavy drinker up until he passed away a few years ago. And even my dad, I didn't consider him an alcoholic, and I can't say that any of these people are alcoholics because none of them were ever in recovery, but my dad enjoyed a good beer or two or three. He would come home from work and stop at this corner store and buy beer, and he would sit in the living room after dinner watching television, and there was always empty cans of beer beside him. He would just fall asleep, but that's what I saw, and I hated it. I just hated it. It just seemed like there was drinking all around me. So skipping ahead a few years, by the time I went to college, I had absolutely no self-esteem. To be honest with you today, I don't remember much about my middle school and high school years. I just don't remember. People have talked with me, they friend me on Facebook, and they say we graduated together, and I have a hard time remembering them because I've blocked out a lot of that time. Some of it has started to come back as I'm dealing with my own recovery, but it was pretty deep-seated, and it has been for years. But when I went to college, I had no self-esteem whatsoever. I followed my sister to the college that she attended because I didn't want to go somewhere where I didn't have at least something to grab onto. So I went to the same college my sister attended. Although we were not close and we didn't really share a lot of things, I still knew she was there. I seemed to always be the outcast, and that was my perception. I mean, people have told me since going through college that they didn't think I was an outcast. They thought I was a pretty good person. But my perception is what drove everything. And so, in my opinion, I was just an outcast. And I didn't know how to form any kind of a real or healthy relationship. So I usually gravitated toward the guys who drank or did drugs. That was just, even though I would say I hated alcohol, that's who I would gravitate toward. I really don't know why, but I did. So by the time I graduated from college, I had gravitated toward this one guy who was older than me, and he was a very heavy drinker, and he was into drugs pretty good. But, you know, he paid attention to me, and he made me feel like I was important. He put me on a pedestal, and I later learned that was very unhealthy, but that's what I wanted. And so my whole family hated him, just hated him, and they tried to tell me that he wasn't the one for me, but I couldn't nor would I listen to them. So he and I got married shortly after I graduated from college, and he took a job down here in Texas, so I moved from Michigan to Texas. I took my first plane ride when I moved to Texas, and because I was this Midwestern small town girl who was going to follow this, you know, bigger than life guy who was going to give me all of my dreams, everything that I wished for, because I really did want to be a mother of the 2.5 children with the white picket fence and the dog, and that was mine. In fact, when I got married, my wedding dress had to look like Cinderella's ball gown. That's what I wanted. That was the picture that I put in my mind. So I left my entire family. And at this point, I had to make a choice. It was him or it was my family. It couldn't be both. And of course, I chose him. So I left my entire family behind and didn't have contact with them for about 6 years during the time I was married. So during our honeymoon phase, you know, the few months after we got married, things were pretty great. I mean, I thought, I have it made now. I can leave behind all the stuff that I felt I had gone through. So I was liking the married life. It was hard. I mean, there were some things I needed to get used to, but it was pretty good. And besides, one of the biggest things was I was out of my house. I was out of my mom's house, and I didn't have to have it. She couldn't tell me anything anymore. So that was a big motivator for me. So things were great, but they didn't last. That honeymoon phase didn't last. My husband started drinking quite heavily and picked up several DWIs. He spent time in jail. He called me from jail one early morning to bail him out, and I didn't even know how to do that. I had no clue. So I had to call a friend of his, and then, of course, he got mad because I called the friend of his, but, you know, he got bailed out, but then he had to go back to jail on weekends for a couple of months. And I tell you, insanity is when, for me, when you throw a welcome home party for your husband because he's out of jail. Yeah. Made his favorite dessert, had the whole, you know, the whole nine yards going because, yippee, you're home from jail. Yeah, who does that? Who does that? We do that. So he promised, though, that after he did that last stint in jail that he was going to stop. He promised that he was going to stop. And so I thought, well, that's great because I want to get pregnant. I want to have kids. You know, those 2.5 kids. I didn't have the white picket fence house, but I had my husband. I had married in a ball gown. So I was moving on. I was going to work down that list. So I figured, you know, if I got pregnant and we had a child that we could support and care for, then he'd stop all that because he'd be so involved with us and the family would start again. And it did, for a while. Just like everything else that I had experienced, I would have periods of great and wonderful, and I'd get my hopes way up, and then they would be dashed. But it just kept repeating itself. So I did have a child. We had a son, and my husband was over the moon. and I don't mean to make and I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say it. He was just very macho about the fact that he had a son. His firstborn was a son. And so he doted on that son like there was no tomorrow. That son became his life, and Kelly became no one's life. So I was again put on the back burner. He was so proud of his son. He spent all of his time with his son. And Adam, my son, became his. And so I, again, was left out. And of course, I didn't have the family. I didn't have my family. I wanted so much to call my family and to talk to my family, but I didn't dare because my husband was rather a hothead, and I was afraid. I was just afraid. Up to this point, he'd never done anything physical to me. I mean, he, you know, would say things to me every once in a while, but it wasn't anything I thought warranted any kind of further investigation. But I didn't have my parents. I didn't have my mom. And I did wish that I had my mom, even though I was so angry with her. So I had another great idea. I thought, well, if one child was good for him, then two would be even better, and maybe this one could be mine. What a warped way of thinking. What a super warped way of thinking. Now, I didn't really know that I thought all of that until I started working this program, but that's basically what it was, is I wanted something for me because I wanted to fill a space for me. So, unfortunately, that wasn't a good idea. It turned out to be a very bad idea. My husband started to emotionally and verbally abuse me on a pretty much daily basis. That abuse became the norm in my house. I decided at this point that he really didn't want this child that I was pregnant with, or that he already had his. So I started to form this almost unbreakable bond with this child that I was carrying. And I can remember sitting at night, singing, talking, reading stories to my child while he was out drinking or doing whatever. And of course, I loved my son Adam, and I doted on him as well, but it was just different in my mind. It was just different. The night that I went into labor with Christopher, who happens to be my second son, I had to call a friend to come get me, to take me to the hospital, because I went out to the living room to get my husband, and he had passed out and was just not to be woken. I couldn't get him awake. I got to go to the hospital. I'm in active labor. Well, I ended up having a friend come get me, and so began my journey with my son Christopher, because I birthed that child by myself. And I felt at that moment, when I first held Christopher, I formed a very unhealthy attachment to a very small child, thinking he was going to fill all of the voids in my life. I felt now that I was in control of someone, that nobody had to be in control of me, that I could finally take some control back. And then our married life, just became one of my son Adam and his father, and Christopher and me. And it just became a very definite split in there. I was married to my husband for 6 years, had my two children, and after the birth of Christopher, 6 months after I had Christopher, I divorced my husband. And I lived apart from him for 3 years with my two boys. I took care of and raised my two boys for the next 3 years. And then, I'm almost embarrassed to say, but it's part of my story, I remarried their father again. He promised. He had gotten help. He promised, you know. I remember being on the phone with his father, and his father saying, "Oh, please take him back. You're so good for him." And like the good Al-Anon that I am, I took him back. And we remarried and continued on. And again, the first few months was fabulous. But it didn't last. So his verbal and emotional abuse became even greater toward me. Physical abuse started to occur. And I hid a whole lot of things from a whole lot of people. He seemed to target a lot of his verbal and emotional abuse when I wasn't around on Christopher. And Christopher would get the brunt of anything. So I began to lie for Christopher because my husband expected both of his children to be perfect. And they had to make A's in school, and they had to make sure that they never got in trouble. Now, my oldest son, Adam, never made A's in school, always got in trouble in school, but that was okay with my husband. He was an athlete, my oldest son, Adam. He was very gifted in martial arts, and my husband loved that. And so if Adam messed up at school or if Adam did something at home and should have been punished for it, he didn't get punished or he would just get spoken to. But Christopher comes home with a spelling test with a 80 on it, and all hell broke loose. So there was such a divide, such a difference in the way the two were being handled by their father. And one day I walked in from work and I could hear as I was coming out of the car into the house, it was just a huge ruckus going on in the house. And I walked in and my whole house had been torn apart, and there was my husband right in Christopher's face. And I don't know what I had put up with all of this crap for it had been 6 years again. And I had put up with it for so long. But that day, he was in my son's face, in my son's face. He was toe-to-toe with my son. So I can remember stepping between them and daring my husband to hit me. Just hit me. And in the same breath, telling Christopher to call 911. And I thought, God, what mother has to have their son call 911 because their father is just a freaking lunatic? But the police came, and my husband had gone. He got in his car and tore off out of the driveway, ran through the front yard, and just about ran through a tree. But he was not there when the police came. And I remember the police looking at me and saying, "Ma'am, what did you do?" And I said, "Nothing. I tried to keep my son and my husband from having a fight, and I stepped in between them." And he said, "Well, why don't you find a place to go? Why don't you leave? You take the children and you leave and let him cool off." So when I got to my fourth step inventory and we had to write resentments about people, places, things, and institutions, HPD was number one on my list because I thought, you're here to help protect me. And they didn't do a damn thing to protect me. So at that time, I made the decision. I found an attorney and I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I got strength from somewhere. I think it was the fact that he and my son had gone toe-to-toe. But I did end up divorcing him for the second time for good. And I took Christopher to live with me, and Adam went to live with his father. And Chris and I didn't see Adam for a while. And there's still lots of stuff that has to happen between us and that relationship. But for my safety and the safety of Christopher at that time, I needed to leave and I needed to take him with me. So Chris and I managed, and I did for him as I had always wanted to. You know, I made sure he wanted for nothing. You know, I was a single mom, I was a teacher, so I wasn't making a whole lot of money. But if he wanted something and I could afford it, he'd get it. And, you know, I can remember not eating in the evening sometimes because I wanted food on the table for him. He never really asked for much. I mean, he never really demanded or said, "Mom, I want this." He just got it. If he had said something about something he wanted, then I remembered that, and when I had the money, he would have it, because I didn't want him to want for anything. And so he's in seventh grade. We moved into an apartment, and at that time, you know, the next couple of years was tough financially. It was hard, but I tried to provide for Christopher the best way I could. And I never realized at that time that alcohol and drugs were making their way into our lives. So my official journey, because I feel I should have been in Al-Anon when I was 8 years old, had I had that opportunity, or Alateen at that opportunity, I should have taken it. But my official journey in Al-Anon began 3 years ago, on June the 6th of 2016. And that's when I first walked in to the Al-Anon program. My now 27-year-old son, okay, so now he's not in seventh grade anymore, he's 27 years old, and I'm supporting him. He's living in my home. He still lived with me, and he'd been using and drinking for the better part of 10 years that I didn't know about, and let me rephrase that, I didn't want to know about, because today I can see signs. But did I see them back then? Oh, gosh, no, because he was perfect. He was just perfect. So the event that brought me through the doors here, actually at the Bay Area Club, happened at the end of May of 2016, just the week before I entered my first meeting. I walked out of my house because I was looking for Christopher. He'd called me from work and said, "Mom, I'm on my way home from work." Okay, took him about an hour at the most to get home from work. And it was our habit, excuse me, it was our habit that when he left work, he called me, and then when he came in from work, he would come, I was usually in bed, because he usually would get off about 10:30, 11, and he'd come knock on my door and say, "Mom, I'm home," and he'd go right to his room. And that was just what happened over and over and over. And, you know, a few nights he was late, a few nights, you know, I would want to know where he was going and what he was doing, but for the most part, he was pretty good at just coming in when he told me he was going to come in, although we never really had a face-to-face conversation. It was just a "Mom, I'm home" thing. But this particular night, he had called me, said he was on his way home, and it's now like 2:30, and I'm doing the, you know, looking at my phone. Why isn't he texted? I'm texting. I'm calling. Nothing. You know, and I'm starting to freak out. And so I had my pajamas on, I got my house coat on, got my slippers on, got my purse, and I went out and I was gonna run the roads looking for him because I knew something had happened to him. I just knew it. Didn't know what I was gonna find, and I didn't, at that moment, that wasn't even in my thought process. I just wanted to know where he was. So I walked out of the house and I noticed his car. And I was like, well, that's weird. So I walk over to his car and he is passed out, half in and half out of his car. And I'm like, what's going on? And here I'm talking to him. What is going on? What's wrong? You know? Well, his car was a trash heap. He had bags of trash everywhere. Now, I should have known this. I should have known this. But I didn't look at his car. I didn't look in his room. I didn't do any of those things because that was his domain. So I remember carrying him in the house and steady in his ear the entire time. He had kind of gotten up out of his little stupor enough that he could walk and he could open his eyes and tell that I was helping him walk in the house. But I was steady in his ear, and I kept saying, "Christopher, you could have hit somebody and killed somebody. You could have killed yourself. You could have been arrested for DWI. Like, is he listening to me? No. I'm not even realizing that he's not hearing anything. But I go on. I keep going. I'm just the little bug in his ear, kept on and on and on. I said, "You know, Christopher, you have a drinking problem. You're just like your dad." So the shaming, I started in on that. And I didn't even think that was wrong. I didn't. I wanted to shame him to get help. So I told him that night that he needed to find help right away or he was not going to live with me anymore. So that was just the first threat of countless threats that I made through the time that I was with him. So, you know, he was like, okay. So I went to bed that night thinking, okay, he's going to contact somebody. He's going to get some help tomorrow, and things are going to be fine because it was okay for me. I didn't realize that he didn't hear anything I said, or if he did, he wasn't going to remember what I had said. So when I got up for work the next morning, I wrote him a note reminding him that he had to go find help or he wasn't going to be able to live at my house. So I get home from work that night, and I can't remember all, you know, the exact order of things, but he did say he had contacted an AA program and he was going to start going to AA. And I was like, hallelujah, praise Jesus, he is now going to get help. I'd been talking to my sister off and on for a while, and she knew a little bit about what was going on. I mean, I would not have said a thing to my very best friend. I didn't say a word about anything that was transpiring in my home to anyone. But I called my sister and I was talking to her, and she said to me, you know, Kelly, there's this thing called Al-Anon. Have you ever thought about going there for you? And I said, no, I don't even know what it is. And she said, well, you know, I have some friends who are recovering, and, you know, they know that their family members have been, and they think it's a pretty good deal. So maybe it's something you should look into. So I did. I looked into it, and I found a meeting, and so I came on June the 6th of 2016. And I walked in the doors of the room and sat down, and I thought, I am going to find out how to stop his drinking. They're going to tell me step by step what to say to him, what to do, and we're going to have that wonderful life that we should have. Now, mind you, he's 27. He's not my husband. He's my son. But I'm treating him, you know, totally different. So I sat down. I thought, yep, I'm going to find it out. I even had a pad of paper and a pen I was going to write down all the steps on. And I sat there waiting to hear those words. And I waited. And I waited. And I saw people that had smiles on their faces. And they shared their wonderful experiences. But I kept waiting because nobody said how they did it. They just said, this is how I feel now, or this is what's happening with me now. And they were talking about themselves, and I wanted to know how to help him because, you know, Lord, no, nothing was wrong with me. I just needed to find help for him. I can't tell you what I heard that night. I can't tell you who was there. I can't even tell you how many people were there, men, women. I can't tell you that. But I do remember very distinctly hearing a woman speak that night, and she made this statement that floored me. And I remember it today, and I will remember it for always. She was talking about her loved one, and her loved one was still in active addiction. And she said that nothing that she did or nothing that she said ever made a difference in stopping her loved one from drinking or drugging. And then she made this statement, and I don't know if this person remembers this statement or not, but she said, I could strap a cage onto my back with my loved one locked inside, and she would still find a way to get drugs or alcohol. That was so profound. That touched my heart in a way that nothing had ever touched my heart. So I began to realize at that moment that I wasn't going to get the magic recipe, that there was nothing that I was going to be able to say or do, and that I was just going to have to work on me. So I said I was going to work on me, and I kept coming back to Al-Anon, and I continued to try at home. I mean, I wasn't perfect, of course. In the early days of coming to Al-Anon, I fought a losing battle because I kept doing the same things that I had been doing. You know, I figured that if I just cried hard enough, if I just yelled loud enough, if I just threatened him one more time, or if I just begged, I was real good at begging, if I just begged one more time that he'd stop. And then I even thought, you know, if I just say it in a different way, I'm going to say it's the same thing, but I'm just going to say it differently. Maybe he would hear that. But of course, nothing ever helped. Nothing ever did any good. So I figured, you know what, I need to keep coming to these meetings. I need to find the woman who made the profound statement, and I needed to ask her to be my sponsor. Because she had what I wanted. She truly had what I wanted. And I tell you what, man, I was scared to death to ask. I was real scared to ask. But, you know, when you're hurting heart bad enough and you want something badly enough, you'll do what you need to do. And so I did. And so we began working 12 steps. So I remember having our first meeting and talking about step one, admitting that I was powerless and my life had become unmanageable. I thought, you know, I know I'm powerless over his drinking. I knew that going in. But she had me write this list of everything that I was powerless over. And I thought, nothing. I'm powerless over Chris's drinking. And we would talk, we had conversations, until I started to realize that, man, I had no power over hardly anything. I had no power over the drivers that were driving on the road in front of me. As I screamed at them or flipped them off or did whatever, you know, I had no power over them. They were going to do what they were going to do, regardless. You know, I was being told, it was being shared with me that the power I thought I had over Christopher the day I gave birth to him, I really didn't have. And that was a hard pill to swallow. I went on to write about how my life was unmanageable. And, you know, I had to swallow some pride there to actually admit the things that were going on in my life where I was unmanageable. You know, I had to admit that I couldn't sleep at night. I had perpetual indigestion at all times. And I'd begun eating every single thing in sight. You know, one time, not while I was working this step with my sponsor, but previously, in the first time I was married to my husband, I can remember being so unmanageable at that time that I literally drug a chair to the refrigerator, opened the door, and ate from the refrigerator. Food became that kind of a solace to me. So although I did not do that this time, I was still eating everything in sight. I stopped doing the things that I liked to do. I loved to run. And I had been trained, and I had trained for a half marathon, and I loved it. I'd stopped doing that. I loved to read. I'd stopped reading, because my everything was hyper focused on Chris, and everything had everything to do with getting him sober. I told my sponsor I had a hard time saying no to people, so my life was unmanageable because I would give of myself when there was really nothing to give. Because I didn't want to say no. I didn't want to hurt people. I didn't want them to think I couldn't do something. So I was just a mess. Just flat out a mess. I remember at one of our get-togethers, my sponsor had me read chapter 5 of the Big Book on page 58. She said, read that and read it out loud. So I read, "There's no easier, softer way. That I needed to be fearless, and that half measures would avail me nothing." And we talked about that word, half measures avail me nothing. And that's when I realized that I either did it or I didn't do it. I either jumped in with both feet and did the deal, or I didn't. And because I wanted to do the deal, I did. And I let some of that stuff go. And then we moved on to believing in a higher power that could restore me to some sanity. And I thought, well, I already have God. I already know. I got him. He's been with me since, you know, I was baptized, I was confirmed, I went to church, I read the Bible, I sang in the choir, I sang in the praise team and worship team. I did all the church things, so I didn't figure that I needed to come to believe because I already believed. But what I really found out was that the God that I walked into step two knowing wasn't the God that I left knowing at all, at all. We worked on that for quite a bit. You know, I heard someone say they ride the crazy train. They were the conductor on the crazy train. That was me. I rode the crazy train. I rode the roller coaster, you name it. My life was just totally crazy. And I wanted some sanity. You know, I did some really crazy things. I did so many crazy things today that I went back and looked at some notes that I had of my list, and I thought, oh my God, you really did that? Yeah, I really did. I did some really crazy things. One of the craziest, I think, for me, that really bothers me today is that one time I laid in bed wondering, what did Christopher have on today? Because when the police come to my door and want to know a description of him, I don't know what he was wearing. Who does that? Who does that? Yeah, I was insane. So I had to figure out, and through speaking through step two, I did realize that the God of my understanding was not the vengeful, mean God that I had when I came in. He wasn't the God that I could make deals with, which is what I had been doing. I had to believe that my higher power was somebody who I could just talk to. I could just share things with, and that if I was quiet enough and still enough, that I would hear an answer. It all came together for me when I heard another person speak in a meeting about this very same topic and saying that her higher power, she thinks of as a father, and his hand is outstretched, welcoming her onto his lap to just have a conversation. That spoke volumes to me. That just really did, and that helped me to realize that my higher power is there for me to talk to, and he'll answer when he's ready. And it's not going to always be in my time, which makes me mad sometimes, but that's what it is. And I did come to believe that. So then I went on to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this new higher power that I had. And I was okay with that. I was okay because, like I said, I had been hurting enough and I was done. I was tired of hurting enough. And so with this new God of my understanding, I knew I could talk to him and give him my life and my will and that things were going to be okay. And so I did that. And then I thought I had completed that step, and when an incident happened about a year later of having worked through that step, where I truly gave my will and my life over to the God of my understanding, because my son had tried to commit suicide, and I did not know what to do. And I remember begging and pleading that my higher power just look after my son and do with my son what he will do. And I actually could say that and do it. I mean, it hurt, but I knew at that point there was absolutely nothing I could do. But I knew there was someone who could, and I learned that through step three. I had to learn patience. I had to learn the statement, "Thy will be done," not Kelly's, but "Thy will." I got to step four, and I had heard horror stories. I had heard people talk about, oh, it's tough, it's rough, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road. And, you know, I thought, oh, my gosh, what is all of this? But I was so ready, I think. I think I was just such a student of the program at that point that I wanted to know more about me, because that's basically what it was. I needed to find me. And my sponsor told me that it's like peeling the layers of the onion away. to get to the core. And we're not going to always get to the core. I haven't gotten to the core. I don't know if I'll ever get to the core because I find new things all the time. But it was emotional. Absolutely. Was it hard? Absolutely. But it was something that I had to do. I told the story of my grandfather to my sponsor. She's the first person that had heard that story. It was hard. It was hard. And I remember one time in particular, we were sitting talking about stuff, and I said, you know, there's this teacher at school who I just really have a hard time going by. I don't like going by his classroom. I don't like being in faculty meetings sitting beside him. And there's nothing wrong with him. He's a great old man. I mean, he was a grandfatherly type. And I was thinking, okay, grandfather, maybe. But, I mean, he was just so pleasant. And he was always so nice and inviting and welcoming. And as I was talking about that, this switch turned on, and I realized the reason that he made me so uncomfortable was because he wore Old Spice cologne, and that's what my grandfather wore. It was that. It was just that one thing. I would not have realized that, nor would I've ever figured it out, had I not just been speaking about that with my sponsor. And I almost thought I had to make amends to him because I thought, I mean, I wasn't rude to him ever, but I'd walk around the building to go not go by his classroom. It was just the way things work. But I think my step four and step five, when I was able to verbalize, speak everything that was going on with me, was very helpful for me. It was very rewarding. There's still, like I said, there's still stuff coming out, and I know there will be for a long time, but it's me, and I want to get to the bottom of it. So we moved on, went to step six, where I had to be entirely ready to remove all my defects, to have my higher power remove my defects of character. Boy, I didn't know I had any. I really didn't think I had any. Working that inventory, I did find out some things about myself that were very telling, but not very easy to hear or to discover. I didn't like being thought of as selfish and self-centered, because my God, I had given myself to so many people and everything, but there was always something attached to that giving. It was because of something I wanted, or I wanted to feel a certain way. I had to discover that. The one that I really didn't like at all was the fact that I was dishonest. I found out that I was dishonest, and to me that meant I lied. And people who know me today know that I hate liars. I don't like it. I don't lie. I just don't lie. Well, I do. And that was a hard truth for me to find. I was dishonest to people because I wouldn't tell them the whole truth. Not because I would tell just a bald-faced lie, but because I just wouldn't tell them the whole truth. Or I would tell them half-truths because I didn't want to hurt their feelings. You know? Yes, I'll do those papers for you, Miss Galavese. I'll do whatever you want. I'll stay till 10 o'clock tonight. Absolutely, I have nothing to do tonight. You know, that's what I did. So I was told during this step, this is where I have to sit with God. It's a God step. I was going to sit with God, the God of my understanding, this new God that I've discovered, and I had to become willing to accept all these character defects and then be willing to change. And then I was told, you need to have some patience because they're not going to go away immediately. And because I wanted the recovery so badly, I did it. And I remember praying with my sponsor and then going home and hitting my knees and praying again. And it was hard to wait. It was hard to wait because I wanted everything all tied up in a bow and be done. But I'm still waiting for some of them, for a lot of them. But I can admit I was entirely ready, and I did humbly ask him to remove them from me. And then step eight, making a list of all the persons that I had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. That was not so hard for me. Okay, the actual saying, I'm going to make amends, I made the list of the people, and my sponsor shared with me that we can make a list in three columns. And we can have the, yes, I want to make amends to you right now. And yes, the second column, yes, I'm willing to make amends to you, but not right now. I've got some, you know, work to do. And then the third column is the hell no, I'll never make amends to you. And I had some of those. And I still have some of those. But making those amends, I knew I had to. I was willing to. And that helped me to see that in the next step when I had to actually make those amends to the people, that I could do that. At the suggestion of my sponsor, I wrote out an amends letter. And I was just so happy. I just was so pleased with this amends letter that I wrote. I mean, because I was a teacher, and I certainly knew how to write a letter. So I wrote this letter out, and, you know, I knew how to make an apology. So I was really 100% sure that this letter was great. So I sent it off to my sponsor, and she sent it back to me. And I want to think that it was lovingly that she'd scratched it all to hell. That she'd scratched through a lot of it. And I mean, I sent this like page and a half letter, and it was now like a paragraph, you know, because my tendency was to say, I'm so sorry that I did blah, 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 because blah, 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 blah. You know, I didn't want to hurt their feelings. I wanted to explain why I didn't or did do something. And so it was hard for me, okay? That was hard. But I did realize, I did figure out that making that amends letter was just letting someone know that I know that what I had done, I was taking ownership and responsibility for the things that I had done to that person. And so then I was able to write those short letters and share them. I shared them with several people. The one that I wish I could have shared, well, no, I guess I didn't. I did a living amends to my mother, but I did have an amends with my mom. And boy, I remember going up a year ago this past summer to Michigan to visit with her. My sister and I went together, and I had my amends letter with me, and I was going to read it to her. I just couldn't find the right time, you know. And then, you know, things happened, and we left to come back home. And I hadn't done the amends with her, and I was really bothered by that. About 6 weeks later, my mom ended up here in Houston living with me. She had been diagnosed with leukemia and was receiving treatments at MD Anderson. And we spent the first 4 months of the 10 months that she lived with me in turmoil. And I was really in that place. I kind of went back to my childhood. I was in that place again. But through working and calls to my sponsor and realizing some things, my mom and I made amends. We really did. I gave her eulogy about 3 weeks ago. And in my eulogy, my special memory of my mom is that I remember sitting on the couch in the living room with my mom, or on the back porch with my mom, drinking coffee and talking and sharing. And we talked like we had never talked before, and we shared like we had never shared before. And it was during those times that I rebuilt a relationship with my mom. And I became a daughter, and I loved her. I loved her. And so I like to think, and I know, that she knows that my living amends to her was those last 6 months of her life where she stayed with me and saw the bond that we could rebuild. So that, to me, that's my most precious memory. So I know time's running short, so I'm going to quickly go through a couple of these things. I did continue to move on through the steps. I would take personal inventory, and I think I was pretty good at making an amends when I did something to someone. I tried to very much, you know, go right to that person and say, this is what I feel. That's hard, but it's something that I did learn. And prayer and meditation were really never difficult for me. I think I learned to pray as a youngster, but I learned to pray differently as an adult and in this program. The biggest thing I learned about prayer and meditation for me was that I needed to pause. And there is power in the pause. Listening. I wasn't a good listener. And there are sometimes I'm still not a good listener. But I try. I try more than I ever have. And it's hard when you're really wanting to hear something and it's not coming. It's hard to be patient. But there is power in that pause, because the God of my understanding will come through. In step 12, of course, I think of that one as the, I'm going to carry this message to others. This is the part where, like Jamie said at the very beginning, you know, I think the sponsor of the relationship gets the bigger prize. When I began sponsoring, I was scared to death. I was like, oh, what if I tell them something wrong? What if, you know, they become worse than what they were when they came in or something. But, you know, you give it to your higher power, and you ask your higher power to speak for you. And I'm really grateful and very thankful that I sponsor with confidence. I always can go to my sponsor and ask if I have a question. But I feel that I can now sponsor with confidence and know that the message that I'm sharing is something that is heartfelt, and it's been burrowed deep in my heart for always. So as I come to the end, I want to share with you just a couple of things, some absolute truths that I have come to realize from working my program. One, there's power in the prayer. Very important for me. I found power in the prayer, for sure. I also learned that feelings aren't facts. You know, I'm a big one on emotion and feeling. So I had to really realize that feelings aren't facts. I also learned that this program is definitely one of progress, not perfection. I'm not perfect, nor will I ever be perfect. And it's okay. And I have to constantly be asking myself, what is your motive? You know, when my sponsor asked me that, she would ask me that quite a bit, and I would hate it, because I would be like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? What's my motive? I didn't have one, but yeah, I really did. So I had to dig those layers. Yeah, I had to dig. But the number one truth for me in this program is found on page 417 in the Big Book. And if you will indulge me, I'd like to read to you just one paragraph. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. So number one truth for me is acceptance is the answer. So I want to thank you all very much for listening. You don't know how much it means to me. And I'm not nervous anymore. Thank you very much.
Kelly, if you'll stay up here just for a couple of seconds.